We made this.
Hello everyone and welcome to The Time Is Now, Soylent Green is People. My name is Kurt North and I am with you again for this special episode of The Time Is Now. We are going to be covering a commentary. We're going to be doing a commentary on Via Dolorosa. And as the podcast comes to a close, as we head into the final few episodes, we've decided to throw a few specials at you. So over the next few weeks, you'll be getting various different things, which I won't go into just now, but there will be some specials, and this commentary is one of them. So without further ado, I shall introduce my guest, and that is Adam Chamberlain. How's it going, mate? How are things?
Very well, thank you. Great to be here again. How are you?
I'm good. Yeah, I'm good. I've just been speaking off air about I've started running, and I'm feeling it. So if I fall asleep about 20 minutes in, just shout down that microphone and I'll be all right. this lockdown's caused all kinds of problems, so I needed to get myself fit again. So, exactly, because I've avoided it. I've worked throughout, so I've never really thought about it. And, I used to play football a lot and all kinds, and all of that stopped. So I thought, Now's the time. I'm starting to get to a point where I need to do something.
So you'll be running up and down a school corridor, right?
I'm going to run up and down a school corridor. Yeah, very, very true, very true. So we are going to be covering Via Dolorosa. You'll have had the main episode, which was myself, Chris Knowles and Darren Mooney covered that, and obviously Goodbye to All That is the following episode, and we'll briefly talk about that at the end and maybe during the episode itself. This is a commentary, so we're going to be playing the episode and we will be playing it with subtitles on, so you won't hear the episode, but we do welcome you to come and listen along, and we'll go into the sort of more technical details in a minute. But just before we jump into the episode, Adam, what do you, this is the finale, this is the two-parter. What do you make to these finals two, especially Via Dolorosa for now? We'll talk more about Goodbye to All That at the end.
Sure. Yeah, I love this two-parter, I have to say. So I think I mentioned when I first came on for this season that I actually saw this two-parter before I saw the rest of season three, just because I didn't have access to season three when it aired. And so it was the special edition release of these two episodes and then the X-Files Millennium crossover. And I loved them then. It just plays like this very sort of slick thriller. I think it really benefits from being a two-parter, and so the story gets space to breathe as well. And so I would score this a 10 out of 10 an episode. I was very liberal with my 10 out of 10s on 7-1 a few weeks ago. Yeah. But this is definitely a 10 out of 10 episode to me. I think it's excellent. It's Millennium, but it's at its best, and with a decidedly sort of Thomas Harris vibe to it as well. It has that that sort of expansiveness to it, that it just feels like a film, really.
Yeah, I would echo that. It's interesting because when we've already recorded the Via Dolorosa episode coverage, and I hadn't rewatched Goodbye to All That, and it's really interesting now that I've actually watched that episode today, and looking back at the first part compared to the second part, I was kind of maybe had my hands tied behind my back a little bit when I was talking with Via Dolorosa, because I didn't really think about it in that way. There are two very distinctive episodes within it, but it is interesting how they do meld together. And, the fact that they've got two separate writers on each episode is in itself is interesting, that they went down that route, really. Because there's a lot to pack into the episode, isn't there?
There is, absolutely, and it's interesting too. So we've got the script here that I know we're going to make reference to probably as we go through, and it's quite a long script, and it's notable that there are scenes that have been cut from the script. You can see that scenes have been omitted, but also stuff that's on the page that never makes it to the episode. So it's quite clear this sort of ran long and that to be edited. And there are a number of changes from the script to the screen. And you know, I guess it's not necessarily uncommon in of itself. But there is a lot going on. And there's even stuff on the page that doesn't make it to the screen, some sort of subtleties and so on. But there is a lot to pack in. But I think in terms of the character of Lucas Barr that we'll get to know and we'll talk about, the character gets room to breathe and we get to sort of understand the background, perhaps in more depth than you do in a standard Millennium episode that needs to have everything wrapped up in 42 minutes.
Mm, and here's an interesting script that you do have as well, isn't it? Because it's got handwritten notes on it.
Yes, so this was Claire Scott's copy of the script, and yeah, and it has some of her notes for herself on how she's going to deliver some of the lines and what her approach is to some of it, which makes it a particularly interesting artifact, yeah. I think. Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, the one thing I will put in my proviso is I've went through the script very briefly with looking at some of the notes that she made. I haven't gone in as much detail as the extra scenes and things like that. So, by all means, just nod them out if you feel it's appropriate.
I'll pull a few things out that are of interest. Yeah,
absolutely. So we'll get them ready to set up. So as I say, we're watching the DVDs. I'm assuming that it's the DVD that you're watching as well, because there isn't any other way apart from maybe my backup collection on my digital copy that I got from the DVD itself, but. It's a shame. I would love it, absolutely love it, if we have this on Disney Plus at some point.
So yeah, there was an advert on the. I'm old enough that I subscribe to the Radio Times, sort of fuddy-duddy that I am. And there was an advert on the, like a full page advert on the a wraparound advert on the front of the Radio Times last week, or maybe even be this week's edition actually. And it features logos and call outs for all these shows and sort of Fox shows, of course, featuring significantly. And I was scouring it, going, I know Millennium's not going to be here, but I'm going to scour it all the same, looking for that Millennium logo. And yeah. Sadly, it wasn't there, but maybe someday soon.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, Disney Plus is Europe and UK wide for those people who may be across the pond, but that they've taken a lot of what Hulu have over there. And, you know, we saw the X-Files pop up on their early doors, and it was like, right, they've got the X-Files, they've got Lost, they've got all the ABC shows, they've got Lie to Me, which only had two or three seasons. And I was like, if they're doing Lie to Me, hopefully, fingers crossed. And as you say, that list came out, and I was like, no, okay, I'll walk away. But you know, never know. If it gets a renaissance on Disney Plus, you know, we may well come back and we may do some specials on that. But let's have a look at this episode then. Let's start to get ourselves ready. So as I say, we're going from the DVD. The way that I'm doing it and the way that Adam's doing it, we spoke off air, is that we have set the DVD players up and we've gone through the first 10 or so seconds and then press the back button on the DVD remote so that we can quickly press pause. So we're about 1 second in. I'll do a 3-2-1 count and we shall go press play when I say play and then just follow along with us and we shall talk through it. And by all means, keep your volume on low or off. As I say, we're keeping it off purely for reasons, as you could imagine. That, you know, we've got to concentrate on the footage and stuff like that as well. But we do have the subtitles on. So that's the way we shall do it, and we shall go and do that right now. All ready to go, so I will count down from three, and when I say play, hit it straight afterwards, and then we'll be good to go. So 3, 2, 1, play. You mentioned it, you alluded to it before with Frank and Jordan running down the hallway there, but this obviously is an immediate res, and we don't find out stuff much later on. But it's a lovely scene to get people interested, because it's not something you would normally see, is it? It's quite a an unusual one because it's not action-packed. It's kind of like just ethereal, really.
Yeah, and you only get a snatch of it. So again, in the script here, this is an instance where you get a couple of minutes of this, and actually much more that you'll see behind all that of that scene than actually appears here. Interesting.
Yeah. So what about bringing Cuffell back in then? Because you know he has been mentioned a couple of times. We said that you know in previous episode that. I can't remember which one it was now, but they said that he might have been, they alluded to it, he actually was already dead, but...
It was in 7 and 1.
Yeah.
It's interesting, you get to see Frank Black in a suit and tie, which is just really unusual. That just shocked me seeing Lance in a suit and tie like that. It was shocking as much as anything else. But, I think this is the only time that we see Cuffell on screen. Is that all right? But it's the only time we see him.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. And he's obviously the actor that we mentioned it on the coverage that he's in The Truth, The X-Files, The Truth.
Right, yeah.
And something I hadn't noticed before is actually that reflection. I know that we see it later on in the episodes where you see that. I haven't actually really realised that, you know, you've got Lucas Barr. I've seen him this point where you can see him behind the thing. I never really noticed the reflection before.
Yeah, so. It's interesting. And that's not called out in the script at all, interestingly. It's much more vague in the script. So it's you get these sort of visual clues here. Yeah, absolutely.
Us being British and not having some things like this happen, you know, it's quite alien to us, isn't it? It's kind of like, you know, the fact that the death sentence is in such a way that, you know, that it's quite, whenever you see it on screen, I always got quite a visceral reaction to it.
Yes, which quite rightly so, I think. And I mean, Frank later on refers to it as barbaric, I think. And again, on the page, it talks about there's lots of blood on the page with this as well, in terms of how this is handled, that you don't see here, but it's visceral enough. You don't need it. It's pretty gruesome.
Yeah. And even though with minute things, this is something that we don't talk on the podcast too much because, you know, we're talking in general. But the way that Frank, like, jumps, you know, when the whole scene goes dark, and you've got like the guy behind, the extra behind, holding his hand in the face, and they are portraying this as something that is barbaric, and it's interesting that, you know, that they would go down that route, really.
Absolutely. And and I think Frank says later that you might think his character's seen all this before, but actually he hasn't. I mean, it's the first time he's ever attended an execution as well, and so that reaction is all the more earned. Absolutely. It's our fabulous credit sequence.
Yeah, so what's the situation with the... I don't know if you know, the fact that the pilot is short, is it longer than the normal credits, I believe?
Oh, do you know, I don't know. You've got me there.
Yeah,
I genuinely don't know.
I think it's something like 10 or 17 seconds longer or something. I've never looked into it. I saw it recently and, like, I don't know, maybe...
Now I'm going to have to go back and watch that.
Yeah. I don't know where I saw that. I don't know if it was maybe Troy Foreman, maybe, that might have tweeted something. Or he's maybe put on the X-Cast basement group or something like that. So, which is always interesting. I'm assuming it's maybe just purely because of the production team that's on there. And, you know, you would get this, wouldn't you, in the show where you've got the names coming on the bottom of the screen.
Yes. Yeah, this is where it all starts to go a bit Thomas Harris in a moment.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say actually that when I was thinking about this before, about who leaves the door open anymore, and as I was watching this episode earlier, I was like, I've got my front door open.
I was like, oh. Mine is not open.
Yeah, well, I've got someone downstairs now, so that we're all right. That's good.
Someone you know downstairs.
Someone I definitely know downstairs, yeah. Although I can sometimes be afraid of her.
So what's interesting as well is that that on the page, that the first scene after the credits is actually with Emma and her father, a scene that comes up shortly. So it's interesting that some of this stuff's swapped around.
My question here, right, so I know there's obviously some sexual stuff going on here, but I don't know if you can see in the... when it does go back to the sex scene shortly, at the very bottom that there's hair on the gate, which is a technical thing that they always check to see that the film can sometimes be stripped a little bit and it creates what like a hair effect is. And they often edit it out on the bottom corner. Just there's like a little bit of black line.
I thought that was a euphemism for a moment.
No, well, oh, yeah.
Sorry.
Well, no, it's all right. No, it's fine. Because it's often been, that's something that the production teams use, you know, say hair on the gate, that they'll say, oh, we have to retake it again.
I see.
But obviously, you know, for TV budgets, you can't really do that. You've got to go with it. And I just noticed on this as part of a production thing, but sex is not something that Millennium has done that much. You know, it's been mentioned about Catherine and then obviously recently in Antipar. But, you know, this is their real attempt at kind of, and obviously Darwin's Eye as well, actually. But it's their real attempt at, you know, kind of more sensuous, more like loving than anything else that we've really seen before.
And then you get the contrast with this and the guy with the pliers and all the rest of it. And I think that the contrast makes it all the more effective. And here he is there on this most intimate moment. And it's just horrendous again. Yeah. It's quite a scary episode, this.
Well, I've got a comment to make on the second couple, which I'll leave when we get there. But, but it's an interesting comment. I think I've worked my way around it now, but I took it a different way until recently. So this is him doing the Stations of the Cross. By putting this in with allusions to the pilot, you know, the religious aspect of it, and the fact that he's not in control of his body is, you know, or what he's doing is, it's something I've not really felt too much before. But upon thinking about it, it really does work, that, you know, that aspect of he can't control what he's doing. He's living couple's life, isn't it, really?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Again, it's a scary concept that unfolds through the Simpsons.
So, we've just seen the goggles, the Splinter Cell goggles, as I like to call them, for anyone who's played Splinter Cell over the years on the Xbox and stuff. Marjorie David is someone who came onto the show late, around Force in the End.
Yes.
And I know I've talked about it with a few people. It's interesting how she becomes more of a production person. It seems to be, you know, Chris Carter's obviously maybe behind the scenes as well, but it seems that she has some, that the show seems to change when she comes on.
Yeah, it's interesting. So, and I did listen to the Force in the End episode the other day, and that was, so this is a co-write with Patrick Harbinson, as we've seen on the screen here, but Force in the End that she'd written herself. I think she has those two credits, didn't she, I think, in terms of writing credits.
And another thing as well, actually, I've reevaluated my comment that I've made, which you won't have heard yet, is the I think that coming late to the game for the dad. But upon watching these two episodes, I think these two episodes really solidify this whole thing. And I think that one episode before that is actually quite good. You know, it's the fact that you do have this ongoing story with them, and obviously we'll talk about that in a bit.
The two things I know John Beasley for, so it's this and Everwood. I don't know if you've ever seen Everwood, but he did this a few years. He did Everwood a few years later. He's a very sort of kindly older character, completely different type of character, like an old granddad type character. And he, of course, is
just the sheer presence of him in both this and next episode. Because next episode is, you know, when he does say, what does he says something along the lines of, you know, you shouldn't have done it, Emma. You shouldn't have done it. And, you know, which completely destroys her life, which is, for me, probably the strongest part of both episodes, really, these scenes.
Yeah, these two are so good together in all of their scenes. I think, the absolute heart of this story. And it's heartbreaking, of course. Yeah. Mm.
So this is the scene that you were saying that was originally in the script?
Yes, it was actually straight after the opening credits, which, and it's kind of interesting. There's almost a sort of a lead into this where, well, in fact, it's in the scene we saw before with Frank and Emma at the FBI, and Frank asks after a father, and she goes, oh, you know, he's okay.
Yeah.
And it could have been pointed if you'd seen this scene first, but actually it's quite an interesting sort of transition to go from the conversation they just had to this.
Mm. try and find it on the script now. Where what page we're on?
We're page 12, I think.
12.
There's quite a lot of camera direction on the page, an unusual amount, actually. Not a lot of it's used, I noticed, but going through the script in detail, there's an awful lot of that.
As opposed to like earlier episodes that you've got scripts for, is that some conscious thing you've seen? Or?
Yeah, I noticed. So I also look back at Through a Glass Darkly, which is another Patrick Harbison script, and actually it's similar there. But then you compare that with other scripts, and I just see scripts in general, because I enjoy reading scripts, and there just seems to be an unusual amount of it compared to what you would normally see for a TV script, including scripts for Millennium. Yeah.
I mean, that's quite a visceral, thing, isn't it? I'm surprised they managed to get away with some of this,
There is, for all the blood that wasn't there in that first scene, there's an awful lot of blood that you see and some pretty visceral stuff in this episode, absolutely.
We get Baldwin here as well, obviously his first appearance, and the quick switch around and the almost, throughout this episode, there's bits where he says like things like he needs to be in the psych ward and then hiding out in the house, going back to the house to have a look and all that, which I'm sure we'll get to.
I love that, This scene is very interesting how this plays out, I think.
Yeah. It's stuff with Rice as well. I mean, that will come in back into the X-Files Millennium, won't it? The Rice aspect.
Oh, yes. That's pretty true. But this is interesting, the way Frank asked to clear the scene here.
Yeah.
I was like, what?
It's nice because we've seen Barry all along, being this kind of antagonist to Frank. And the fact that he does go, this is my crime scene, and he still gets the one up. And it gives us that microcosm of like the switch around as we get into the episode further, doesn't it? Really?
Yes, it does. Absolutely. Yeah. It's interesting that the script describes this as Frank like a man in fugue. It says Baldwin is affected by Frank's strange immobility. That doesn't quite play out, but it's kind of interesting how it's described.
Well, we didn't mention, because we were talking at the time, but I always think Modern Family now when I see that, because the main guy in Modern Family always falls down the stairs like in that mold. But
there's an interesting comment on this when he falls on the stairs, because it says he stumbles and falls forward as if a great weight was bearing him down, which of course the whole I think fits very nicely with the station to the cross thing.
Do we see the way he's acting here? Is it, you feel like there's a weight on his shoulders? He's playing it like as if his neck is kind of hunched over a little bit. We get our flash Millennium Frank Black vision flash.
Yes,
as well,
and you get so much from Ernst Henriksen just non-verbally. It's just that detail in his performance. It's just fantastic. Yeah.
I mean, we get the same illusions in the mirror scene later on as well, don't we? So,
absolutely.
The bedpost is something I've not really noticed before. I've actually, strangely enough,
it's strange, isn't it? Then here we get this odd reveal.
I should have, because he says me tie Mrs. Dryden to the bed, so I should have really picked that up.
Yeah,
but never mind. So the holes in the skull, again, referring back to what we're going to find out later. But also things like Skull and Bones and the Millennium Method and, all this theme that's being linked in. It's not a Chip episode as such, but, you can imagine Chip as an executive producer being laying out some of this, can't you, really?
Yes, there's a lot that comes together across these two episodes, absolutely.
Yeah, so what I was saying about Ed Cuffell is that we get the Polaroid that obviously that went past while we were talking, but again, just feeding back everything that we've had in before, this totally reminds me now of Mindhunter. Yeah, this is what Mindhunter effectively is.
Absolutely. Yes. Yes.
So I think it's a prequel. A prequel to that, you know, whether or not anyone was watching it or took the this idea. But I mean, obviously, you know, we know the people behind Mindhunter were actually involved. So, you know, it's been ripped out, as you say, the Thomas Harris effect. You know, it's that kind of thing, isn't it? Everything goes around in circles. So this is where I kind of noticed some of the notes that Claire Scott put on, you know, things like lunge at a certain word, or, you know, I think she says at one point shortly on the tape, it's how you found him. And she's like putting little notes in there saying how how the character feels, but also emphasis on certain words.
Yeah, emphasis, and also how she's going to deliver the that particular line. I think some of the underlinings in the script, some of it's hers, but as you say, it's the sort of the motivation and therefore how she's going to deliver a particular line.
And his psych ward again, you know, playing up to that, you know, Baldwin, Frank, things that we've had in the past. You know, we've had elements where Frank's saying, "You're not wrong, but you just haven't done your job," kind of thing. And, you know, it all adds this kind of antagonistic viewpoint between the two of them, which will quickly flip around shortly.
Yeah, absolutely.
And even this whole idea of the birth of Cuffle, you know, and what made him, what happened to him, and how Frank kind of got in. It just explains everything from, you know, as I say, the genesis of Frank Black and, you know, just the way that, you know, the fact he's just telling this story and how he was born is I think, fascinating.
It is, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, it's a very smart episode in that way, I think, how it refers right back to Frank's origins, stuff comes full circle, doesn't it? Yeah.
It said enough for me to make my way. So it's not even like the wording is really carefully, isn't it? It's not I saw it. It's enough for me to get back. It's abstract. It's not, you know, where some shows might go down the line of like, oh, I'm seeing a one, I'm seeing a two. It's the vision of this. It's like enough for him to get, you know, the idea and for him to investigate it.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And so Claire Scott's put on the scene as she was talking just now, as she's testing out, she's proposing, testing out her theory. Anyway, he may have been sat right behind you. He was. We saw him. Now, this I love this scene. And interesting, there's this scene here with Peter Watts, there is, as he goes into this. This is actually written in a stairwell in the script, but I think it actually plays much better in the lift here for how Watts manages to sort of remain unseen a little later.
Yeah, well, I mentioned this in the recording that it reminds me of Triangle. Now, I know, obviously, you know, the two separate shows, but thematically, as you say, playing that lift thing of, you know, that Peter can't be seen, that Frank is there, that she's caught between those two worlds. It's, you know, it just works. And as I say, a stairwell wouldn't have really worked that way.
Absolutely. This works much better. And this is a particular scene, as you're saying, where Claire Scott's notes on the scripts for different lines. She's saying how she's mocking, she's slicing, she's silencing, she's shaming, she's blocking, she's deafening in terms of each subsequent line that she delivers in this exchange. And I think it that helps add to the power of the scene as well. You see her conflict here and all the rest of it that's going to play out.
And then, there's also a line, isn't it? It says, what does he want versus my daddy? You know, and she's, you can see the lines that she's playing in her head, that she's playing as the character. It's like, you know, it's my daddy kind of thing, and you know, it'll all come to fruition in the next couple of scenes.
And she's also said, "I want everything to be great for a minute," as well, which is kind of heartbreaking. Yeah.
But as you say, that lift, that's the scene they've just seen there, where you've got the two worlds, and where she's stuck. She doesn't know what to do. And inevitably, it's taken out of her hands anyway.
Yes.
Which is another thing I wanted to say just while I remember, is that also in the recording that I was saying that, why do they really want Emma? And then this obviously tells you the story of they want someone in the FBI. You know, it's not so much for her. It's they just want to have someone to manipulate within the FBI so they can control her. And, you know, Millennium Group are all about control.
Yeah, absolutely. And then they also come to say later, I think, that they want Frank out or whatever. Yeah.
We've gone to the trope of enhancing, which is a bit, come on.
although it's Doug, isn't it? Doug Scape, it does say, oh, there's only so much I can do here. So at least it's not a razor sharp image that you get. Yeah. It's a slightly blurry image. It is a bit of that trope, though. You're absolutely right. Now, I have to skip over a few pages here. There's a whole bunch of stuff with Barr finding his next victim that doesn't feature on screen to get to this point.
Oh, right, okay.
Sorry, you were going to...
No, it's fine, yeah. As I say, it's probably why I struggled to find the bits at this point. I remember flipping through the thing going, I can't see where the notes are. Yeah. That makes sense if there wasn't any... there was more to it.
There's a lot more of him some failed attempts to find a victim before he lands on these folks.
So just on this bit then where he's there, he's building himself up to do it and he goes to the windscreen. I mean, what exactly is happening? Is he drawing his Station of the Cross there? Yeah.
I think so, because it states, I mean, you don't really get to see it here, but it states in the script here, so on the windshield, a series of connected lines, a map, a path of some sort. Its identity for now uncertain as he exits the car. So, yeah, again, you don't really get to see it, but I guess it is alluding there to exactly that, that sort of path and Station to the Cross.
The fact that he's got this internal struggle, because it's the same struggle that Emma's having in some ways, isn't it? The fact that he doesn't want to be doing this, he's becoming this because of what the Millennium Group has done to him. But
yes,
at the same time, he's going to the Stations of the Cross because he's understanding that he's feels like he's being controlled.
Good, yeah.
So
yeah.
It's a nice mirror to that as well.
Absolutely, yeah. It's all about Frank's told us in the past. It's always all about control with the Millennium Group.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And the more I've watched these two episodes recently, because it's the final two, because, you know, it's I was doing an extra special on this one as well, then the more that you can see a future for Millennium as well, which is the ironic thing about it. It's like they've found something here. These two episodes are brilliant because they've found almost like, you know, the perfect scope for Millennium to go down, the conflicts that Emma and Frank have got, that, you know, what Emma's going to do later on. You know, it's all wonderfully realized in these two episodes.
It is, absolutely. Yeah, it is. It is. It's a lot more heartbreaking that we don't get a continuation. Although in their own way, I think they make a great sort of finale.
But, yeah. Oh yeah, I think they do. I think it is probably the best 10-13 finale, considering what we've got. You know, the X-Files had seven of them, or whatever many they had. You know, Existence is probably the closest one to having a decent one. Requiem, I suppose, could have worked quite well as well, because I wasn't too concerned. But we've just seen the mirror scene there. He gets caught out, and that's when he does let it slip. He is letting part of, you know, seeing the reflection in him, which I thought was a lovely touch.
I'm sure I'd have gone running out of my house in that state to follow him. Shut the door and locked it.
Yeah, call the police, shut the door.
And here he is, shaking like a leaf, it says.
Well, he's followed the instructions well.
Yes, to be fair, yeah. Love every opportunity to get to see that Cherokee.
Yeah. I was going to mention it actually before when we went to the first crime scene, but I decided against it.
So I drive a red Jeep.
Yeah.
Purely because of Millennium. I've been a red Jeep before. And
I remember you saying. You see, one, why did they move the mirror?
I think. Embarrassment, because it was purely because I'm guessing it was there so they could watch themselves.
Yeah, I suppose.
And I'm guessing it was done from embarrassment and shame or whatever.
You see, this to me always played out that she's having an affair and he's with that. It's not, But it always felt that way to me. Yeah, but it's obviously the fact that she's scared that the video's going to get out because of the videotaping. But it just, I don't know why my brain went straight to affair. Because that's the way she says
it. Could be right. Could be right. Emma's sharp-eyed as ever.
Yeah. You see, this is something I was going to mention, actually. Well, I think it's the next scene, because Frank goes back to the other house, doesn't he? There's elements, and we'll talk about that in a second, there's elements where, give Baldwin that line, where it could have been a bit more fluent that way. It's a bit procedural, it's a bit
right.
obvious to go down that route, and, you know, not good for Baldwin's character, which is a shame. But Emma, as you say, Emma's on the mark, so...
There's a funny line here that I don't think makes it to the final script at some point, to the final version on screen, but it's in the script in there towards the end of the scene where they say, you know, he won't be back. And the guy sort of replays it back. He goes, oh, he won't be back. I'm supposed to be reassured by that. He won't be back. It's like, repeats it power fashion. It's funny.
I did see that line. I actually did see that. I can see it now. I can see the mirror reflecting off the other mirror, which means they can do the triangle of mirrors to see themselves. So. That makes more sense. So this is the Stations of the Cross kind of visions coming
in. Yeah, and they're very specific in the script. Again, it's interesting to look at those flashes that you get that just in a fraction of a second, and they're very carefully spelled out in the script. I mean, as you'd expect them to be, but you almost get more from being able to read it back and piece together what it is you're looking at.
So this would have been after the speech that they had. And to be fair, when I watched it again today, I had that in mind because I'd quickly gone through the script and I was like, they've just had that conversation in my head. They've just had the conversation because it was on the page,
right? So
they were very lucky. But that, I can see why it was cut, because Frank's told them, you know, told the audience, well, they were actually lucky. They're not coming back. Yeah. You know, it's tell them they were very lucky. So this is where we meet Baldwin.
I do love this moment where. Me doing here in the dark. I was trying to be you.
And there has been, as much as like going through this podcast, the good thing about it is that there has been little showcases of tiny things, which could have been more overt, where he does understand that he's really good, Frank. You know what I mean? He's taking it from him. And there's things where he tries to impress him at certain points, but it's just not, for me, it isn't done enough. But this is the perfect, like, again, finding the perfect kind of mix of, like, the understudy wanted to learn off the master kind of thing.
Yeah.
And you could have played with this so much more.
You could have done, yeah. And I guess it's done here because of stuff that's going to happen later in the episode to make that all the more impactful.
This is the scene here, the X, and they are, just let Baldwin say it. It's obviously 12 in Roman numerals. You know, just say Roman numerals 12, and then let Frank continue. And you don't need Baldwin to say two eyes.
Yeah, it does make him sound a bit stupid. Yeah. It's like, yes, have you not seen Roman numerals before, Baldwin? Some of Frank's internal point of view flashes here that are actually missing as well. So they talk about on the page here about, close on a mountain, climbing up a steep rocky hill, bowed down by a heavy burden, he stumbles, warp speed journey down an ancient road to a cross, through it beyond into blackness and stuff like this that I don't think we actually get to see, but I guess you get enough of it from the conversation here as well.
Now, strangely enough, my subtitles have gone off, but it's fine. I know what's happening, so it's all good. Luckily, I've watched it. Not quite sure nor why that happened, but never mind. So this is what I was alluding to before with, you know, his internal struggle that he's having.
Yeah.
So
the barbed wire. Yeah, this is... He plays this very well as well, I think. Yeah. Again, as we transition to the church here, then it's again on the page, it talks about stained glass Station of the Cross, perfectly 10, Jesus stripped of his garments and so on, and then you descend down into this scene. But we don't get some of that, but I think, yeah, the point comes across without being over-laboured, to be honest.
And this conversation in itself, you know, Chris Carter's used this quite a lot with, you know, going to the father and the confessions and things. And when he's not surprised as the father, is he?
Yes. Yeah.
He had violent thoughts and he feels like someone was controlling him, like I mentioned before. And just the way that Frank, you know, Baldwin, it rightly says, you know, he thinks he's being controlled. Cause that's what psychology is about. But yes. Frank's going, no, actually, he is being controlled. And I like that. I do like the, you know, it's not averting to Legion or anything like that either. It feels very kind of straightforward in that way. It could have gone down the Legion route.
And your mind can go there through the course of this episode, but knowing what we know about everything we've seen in Millennium to this point. But yeah, it's great that it's something new. It's something a little different and potentially, well, arguably scarier as well. Oh, now this is a powerful scene again. I think Claire Scott and John Beasley are so good in this scene.
Yeah, the gun. It's just it's horrible, isn't it?
Just this sort of tragedy plays out of this. And don't mess with Emma Hollis.
No, absolutely not. it's a strong fight, though. It is a strong fight. It's somebody in that position where they're not sure who they are, and you know the fact that he's scared for his life, and fear can do a lot of things. Yeah. And for her to like be under that, and that's another thing I like about the show is the way that they play up to that as well.
Yes, this feels very real. This whole, I mean, all of their scenes, but this one in particular, I think, just again visceral in some way. It makes me think of Falling, actually. I mean, just having recently watched Falling and some of the scenes in that.
Yeah, that's going to be... I haven't seen that yet, but it's something that I do want to see.
Difficult watch, like some of these scenes, I have to say. But fantastic.
Right, just so you know, my DVDs decided to play up. So where are we?
So we're now in the old folks' home, basically. Here we are with Hollis having to her father,
and we get obviously the 10-13 actor, of course. You know, who's been in quite a few X-Files episodes, and
yes, and I recognise. I can tell you his name, but yes,
he's been in quite a few. I mean, this in itself, this is what I'm saying by the fight kind of found the feet with. You know, if you think about season one of Millennium, where you've got the Yellow House and Catherine and Jordan, but then you've got something like this with the, you know, the troubles that Emma's having and the decisions she's having to make at this point.
Yeah.
You know, it's not overtly asked, and something I'll ask you later on about the, you know, the actual dementia itself, but it is like a heartbreaking for stuff like this to happen, really.
It is, and so Claire Scott's headlined this act, Me at My Most Guilty. So the sort of the guilt she feels in this moment of having to do this. She doesn't want to be here. She doesn't want to be having to leave her father here. Which, of course, is very important to the story, too. Particularly moving scenes.
Right, where are we at the moment?
So this is now Emma sort of tearfully talking to her father, holding his hand as he's in the wheelchair. We're both in tears, indeed, in fact.
Yeah. And again, it's just a powerhouse, isn't it, this? I mean, with the you know, the fact that they're both, as you say earlier on, that they're working so hard and doing what they need to do for this. And it's just heart-wrenching, really.
Yeah, he just completely believes every moment of this as well. Could veer into melodrama, but it doesn't feel that way at all. It just feels real. And then just when you thought it couldn't get any worse,
Mr. Watts.
Absolutely.
And again, without jumping on with this within this episode itself, it's interesting his his like kind of rugs pulled from under him in the next episode. But he is overtly trying to bring her back, bring her into the fold, isn't he, really? And she kind of is agreeing at this point as well.
Well, and she agrees. Yeah, I mean, she doesn't overtly agree. She doesn't verbalize it. But, I mean, she challenges him, saying, you know, you've got no right to be here. You're just feeding on people's weaknesses. But again, at the end of the scene, it's telling on the page. It says, hold on, Emma, her implied yes becoming, it says becoming explicit. She nods slightly, which she does ever so slightly at the end of the screen. But yeah, it's... Yeah, and this is where Watts is saying that they want Frank Black still has important work to do for the group, which is interesting. It's wasted at the FBI. We want him out.
Yeah. So, do you think that? I know we'll talk about this later, but do you think that was the remit was to get him out so they could work back on getting him back into the group?
It seems that way, and that's why they want Emma on side. Yeah, so we've cut back now to Cornico and Baldwin and Frank discussing this.
I'm back up with you now.
Okay, yeah. Good stuff.
If it's where I'm at, he's walking towards the door. Baldwin's at the door. Is that the one? And they start talking about...
Yeah, so look, actually, obviously in the conversation now, Emma's just appeared at the door here.
Yeah.
They haven't realised she's there yet.
It's a wonderful piece of direction. It's something that I mentioned in the recording that, you know, just to have this, like, it's happened twice now. And the fact that you've got the ear shot of what Frank's saying. We've had the psych thing earlier, and which is more overt because you could see Frank coming in. But this one, you can physically see Emma holding back.
You can, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. There's an interesting end of this scene as well. So Frank, in a moment, he goes on to talk about Cuffell's background and that Barr will have the same background and so on, and hence he was selected. And there's a few lines of dialogue that are excised from this from the end of the scene, because Frank says, you know, my guess is that's how he was selected through his medical records. Mm. And then Baldwin says, you're still not saying selected by whom. And then in the scene description, it states, it's the group. It has to be, but Frank doesn't go there. And Frank just says, let's find him first.
Yeah.
And then it says, so off Frank, looking at Emma, knowing something's up with her and holding his tongue because of it, which I think is quite interesting. And we don't get to see any of that, but it's kind of interesting in terms of the sort of motivation as to why Frank's not going there and saying what he's thinking.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Right. So I'm with Barr now, looking
at
the CV.
Yes.
Okay. So I'm with you. Right. Okay. Sorry, folks, you know, I lost my DVD went off for some reason. So obviously we have here Barr looking at the TV screen. He'll move into, I'm assuming he's in a different house at that point before next episode, and that's his actual home, and, you know, he moves in.
Yes, sir, yeah.
Thing. So this is the stuff which, it's a lovely moment, this, with Baldwin.
Yeah.
He's expecting to be, like, torn to shreds, and he's like, good work, good work.
Yeah. and he's so pleased with his
I do, it makes me smile.
Yeah, no, we do what we can. But yeah, it's a lovely moment, actually. You can tell that Baldwin really appreciates that he's getting Frank's law plaudits at this point.
Mm. And it's a little bit of an ensemble as well. You think of, you know, Shafe and Emma, Baldwin, Frank. You know, Peter's not in this one. It was alluded by Russ that what's his face? Can't really remember. It's now Stephen E. Miller's character. But,
Andy McLaren.
And Andy's not in this one, which is absent.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Yeah.
So this, right, okay, so we're getting to the final bit. Frank is starting to think about this. There was a nod to Emma, where Emma's the one that found it, that you've got a little bit of Frank looking at Emma going, Then later in this scene, we've got when we get Emma getting the page, and you know, so she saved. And then she has the audacity to say, you knew?
You knew, yeah. There's a moment that is apparent. So just before they've gone off into the building there, where it states very clearly, Emma doesn't look at Frank. So Frank's telling them, I don't think she'd go in at the moment, and she won't make eye contact with him, which I think is interesting. And then, of course, they do talk in the end of the episode. I love the score at this point. I know we're watching this on mute, but there's something about Mark Snow's score that really heightens this moment, I think, this attention.
Yeah. Well, I think look at Drill In next week and, what a musical score that is as well, which I know that people have mentioned on the podcast before. Dave Walker mentioned it. So, just how good that is. Russ has mentioned it before as well. So
he's always brilliant, Mark Snow. But And it's interesting there you go, Frank staring into the fire. There you go. Yeah. It's a bit of foreshadowing for you.
Yeah. It's the pull into both the fire and his face as well is really effective.
Yeah, I mean, it's always sort of movie quality, but there's something about sequences like this.
Well, they're playing off a few Dutch angles here and there on this as well, so it is designed in a way to make you feel a bit off balance.
Yes.
You know, with that, as I say, with that zoom in, the Dutch angles that we've got in the hallway, so everything, and then, as soon as anyone comes out of the building, you think, oh, crap.
Interesting that she gets this page right at this moment.
And as well, we've seen this in the show before where you've got Frank gets page and it's 2000. And you half expect it to say 2000, don't you?
You do, yeah. But, again, the fact that it's her father, the page number, that's good. That's the one that's going to make her up and take him, I guess, at that crucial moment.
Yeah, from a theme and a conscious point of view, that it's it's alluding to the fact that this is orb for him kind of thing, which
absolutely, which
is great.
And old Barry, just as we were getting to like him, eh?
I know. We're 42 minutes, and he went through a bit of a story in this one.
It's a great episode for him. Yeah.
It's just a shame.
And then we dissolve into this, and it's such a Bar's journey goes on, and it's I like this as a cliffhanger.
Yeah, I do.
It's understated this bit, but
May 1999 when this was out, so I probably would have seen it late 1999. Ironically, because we got it 6 or so months afterwards. And then we continued. So it's, and that's it. So thank you everyone for listening. We're just going to stop the DVD now, even though mine failed 30 minutes in for some bizarre reason, but never mind.
I want to watch Goodbye to All That right now.
Well,
stop it.
I might have to leave you and let you go.
It's fine.
So, that was the episode. So just a few things that obviously going off the back of that then, bearing in mind this is the end of the episode and we move into the finale, that it sets up so many interesting things. It sets up the struggle for, the danger that Frank has got with Jordan. We find out in the next episode that Peter has been protecting Frank. It's kind of like that cigarette smoking man kind of aspect that I've been protecting you. There's also the elements or stuff like, has James been given this dementia? Because it feels like, it's a one they've never seen before and things like that.
Yes. So, there's a very clear, sense.
And also there's the moment with Emma as well, the fact that Emma's makes a decision that she doesn't want to go through with it, but is then forced to because everything's in motion as such. And as I said, as I alluded to before, we've got we do have Emma with James, and James saying, you shouldn't have done it, Emma. And she's lost everything. She's lost the battle, she's got her father back, but has she? So there's a lot going on there. So what do you make to the final episode after this then? I know you haven't watched it for a while, so.
I haven't watched it recently, but like you say, it's all the more heartbreaking. And again, it's as much as we always talk about wanting a continuation from Lenny, but we'll talk about that. In many ways, it is a fitting finale. And even though there's certain elements, there are certain threads that that we want long to see taken forward. So yeah, as you say, the choices that Hollis makes, and it would have been so interesting to see how that would then play out in terms of actually would she come good again. Mm-hmm. But I think it's in terms of the arc of this season, it plays out beautifully, and it's a very personal finale again in a lot of ways, quite different to the season two finale, of course, in many ways, but there's a real sort of poetry and beauty to it, I think, right up to that final frame. So I love it. I think these are both 10 out of 10 episodes for me, both Via Dolorosa and Goodbye to All That.
I would agree. I deliberately, as I mentioned before, left these two to the end. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the past, I've sometimes jumped ahead and gone, "Oh, watch that episode." Nostalgia is the one that we covered. There was an episode in particular where I was like, "I really like that episode on my last rewatch. I'm going to watch that again." But for these two, I kept right to the end, and as I say, to the detriment of the my Via Dolorosa coverage that. And in some ways, it probably worked quite well because I didn't have the memory of some of the stuff that happens in the next episode.
Right.
So I couldn't like bring that into the conversation, which will be good for the recording that I'm due to do tomorrow, because I've made sure I've done it chronologically. so it's all good. But there's, as I say, there's stuff like, you know, Peter realizing that, you know, he's kind of, I mean, we alluded to it as well early in season where, you know, we see Peter having the dinner, you know, I think it's doing collateral damage, and, you know, then there is collateral damage by Frank forcing his way through. All of this stuff is actually played out actually really nicely. And the Peter kind of twist of, you know, he's been protecting him, we'll give him the satchel. And it would be really interesting to see what was in mind for Frank. But even like sort of Emma, you know, the fact that they've got rid of Peter because they want to put Emma in that place. And not even that, the fact that Emma... it openly admits that that's where she is. You know, it's not a case of like, it's not what you would expect in the X-Files of is she, isn't she? She literally says, you know, what else could I have done? He's my father. So stuff like that, it's I think it would have been great to see what happens in season four. And
absolutely, yeah. And you believe that in terms of her decision as well, but especially for how well they've played in Via Dolorosa, as we just watched, you know, you believe that as her decision. Yeah, what else could she have done? You really buy into her making that decision.
Yeah. And to be honest, it's, you know, she's at the point where she's like saying to Peter, I don't want to go through it. And Peter has to hang up the phone because he's now worrying for himself. You know, there's an element in that part of it. And it's like, all right, you know, and everything is already being set in motion. Peter's going to go. You've got Emma, who's going to be in the FBI. You've got, you know, Baldwin out of the equation. Frank's getting taken out of the FBI. Everything is being set up. All the pawn pieces have been set the right way. The only thing that didn't change is, and obviously stuff like Schaeff as well, where, you know, he gives Frank the address and there's a few little eye looks to each other, which I'm sure I'll talk about tomorrow. But, you know, there is this wealth of stuff that they could have so much delved into. And as I say, I know that Tony and one of our specials is going to talk about the, you know, the virtual seasons. You know, no doubt he'll talk about that in that as well. So that'd be good. But it did set itself up, as you say, for a wonderful ending. A wonderful end to the show, but also it could have quite easily gone further.
It could, absolutely, yeah. And you referenced Peter Watson. I think I do love how his story, progresses further and gets a little bit more complicated, and you start to sort of question some of his where he really stands on some of these things again. There's a tragedy there as well. There's a lot of tragedy in these two episodes.
Yeah, just his realization that, you know, if it was the group, I would have known. It's like, okay. They'll do it for me. And obviously as he, you know, even like little bits that you may well think back to previous episodes, like The Time Is Now, for example, you know, where he goes looking for the, you know, what the Millennium Group did know and stuff like that, but he's being shut out, and, you know, that is a death sentence at the end of the day, and Frank alludes to that. So, but yeah, that's it, Adam. That's your time officially on the show. we're going to mention this as well in the end episode, that, you know, we'll never say never to reopening some files on Millennium, you know, commentaries or the like, or maybe some specials and stuff like that. We've got a few coming up now. We've got the Millennium episode from the X-Files coming up as well. And, you know, Millennium is always close to my heart, as I know it is to yours. And absolutely, there's always an option that if I ever get the urge to watch an episode and do a commentary on it, and we may well do that at some point.
You never know when a satchel with the Ouroboros one may drop into your lap. And
you never know.
Leaf through and find something new to talk about.
Yeah, but I just want to say, I know we talked on nostalgia, but I just want to say thank you very much for doing everything that you've done on the podcast and the Back to Frank books, you know, back to Frank Black book as well. It's been a great wealth of information, and you know, it's a must for any Millennium fan. So, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to come on, and I'm interested to come and do this, something a little different and a little bit challenging in a slightly different way. The commentary, so I've enjoyed that very much, and enjoyed coming back a number of times. So, thank you for that, and thank you for all the kind words about the book. I will accept that on behalf of all the people who contributed to the book, of course, from Troy and James doing the interviews, to all the other people who wrote for that book. So it was very much a joint effort from us all. But thank you very much.
No problem at all. So if people were wanting to find that book or find you online, what's the best way of doing that?
Yeah, so if they wanted to go find the book, you can find it on Amazon, Back to Frank Black, but you can go to fourthhorsemanpress.com and you'll find a lot more information there about the book and other publications from us, from myself and Brian A. Dixon. And I'm on Twitter, so Adam_Chamberlain, just spelled BRLN at the end. You'll find me there tweeting occasionally.
Excellent. And you can find me, as usual, on Twitter at R. Muldrake, at R-M-U-L-D-R-A-K-E. Find me over on the sister show, The X-Cast, which is on Twitter at The X_Cast. I'm on the Red Dwarf podcast as well, which is Shipwrecked and Comatose. We've recorded season 4 at time of recording, and you can find that over at Red Dwarf Pod. And my most recent thing that I've been involved in is the coverage of WandaVision. At time of recording, we're just about ready for the finale. And we're going to be continuing on podcast 616 with various different Marvel things. So I'm taking a step back from that as well, as WandaVision was my main baby that I wanted to cover. But I will be on that show on occasion as well during the other shows. So those are the best places to find me. But until next time, everyone, remember, this is who we are.
Hello, everyone. This is Tony, Network Chief of We Made This. As you know, our podcast network brings together a brilliant assortment of talent who talk about all kinds of pop culture content, such as the episode you've just listened to, or maybe you're just about to listen to. We're not going anywhere, but we'd love to keep the lights on for even longer if you're able to support our network on Patreon. For just £2 a month, you get your name in lights and the satisfaction of knowing you're helping us produce more great audio. And for £3 a month, you'll get your name in lights, but you'll also get access to an exclusive bi-monthly podcast from the We Made This talent pool on podcasting, pop culture, and, well, you tell us. We'll take your suggestions. For less than the price of a coffee per month, you can help keep We Made This going. Just head to patreon.com/WeMadeThis. That's patreon.com/WeMadeThis. And get the ball rolling. Now, back to your scheduled programming.
Elsewhere on We Made This. Free with this month's issue.
If you think about the band name, they didn't even commit to being good themselves, like, because Warm Jets is pretty shit.
Yeah, but it's Here Come the Warm Jets by Brian Eno is where they got it from, which is fucking brilliant album.
Like, trying to do a rock band, naming yourself after a fucking ambient album.
No, it's a glam rock album.
Oh, is it?
It's not one of his ambient ones.
Yeah.
He's got Babies on Fire on it and stuff like that.
Fair enough, then. I still don't think being like, oh, we're the Warm Jets, like, okay, cool.
It's not an exciting name.
That sounds like someone pissing on you in the swimming baths, isn't it? What is that Warm Jet?
Wow.
Oh, it's piss.
Some people are into that, Ian.
I know. Not in the swimming baths, though, right? That's a bit right. Invasive.
It will get you banned from Atherston Leisure Centre, absolutely.
Shipwrecked and Comatose, a Red Dwarf podcast.
podcast.
How is it tiring that we've sat on our arses and watched something on a PC screen? But it really fucking is, isn't it?
Yeah, it was full on. It's full on. Fully enjoyable, but full on, yes, absolutely.
We haven't told people what we're reviewing yet, have we?
No, we haven't, because, you know, that's why I'm edging around what we're talking about.
We're talking about the Hollyhop online Red Dwarf convention, which we both attended. And I tell you what, Kurt, I've had a bloody lovely weekend.
Yeah, it's been great. I've really enjoyed it. You know, it's... As you say, the first day was hard because they've crammed a lot in the first day. Second day, overall, because I think it's been a bit more like a Sunday, because it's a Saturday, Sunday, the recording.
We Buy Records.
Eric Clapton and Van Morrison have released an anti-lockdown song. How do you think about this? Where does this sit on the shitometer?
I think it redefines the shitometer.
Right.
I think it's raising money for musicians who are affected by the lockdown and the lack of gigs, etc. Mm-hmm. Which is a good thing.
Yep.
But then you see Van Morrison and Eric Clapton, a bad thing. So,
right.
Do you know what I mean? I mean, I love Van Morrison's music. I don't particularly like Eric Clapton's music. I quite like the 60s stuff. But, they're a couple of whinging old men, aren't they? Old man babies complaining that they can't go and lick whoever they want.
Ooh.
I know. But that's what they're singing about, I think. I haven't checked that. I assume that the lyrics are about...
You can take it as read that I haven't heard it.
It's not likely to have a banging donk on it, is it?
It's unlikely to have a banging donk.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network.
The Time Is Now, a Millennium podcast, was created by Tony Black and is produced by Tony Black and Kurt North. We can be found on Twitter at The Time Is Now Pod or by searching Facebook for The Time Is Now. We are part of the We Made This podcast network, which can be found on Twitter at We Made This Pod or on the website WeMadeThisPod.com. For bonus material and exclusives, check out our sister show, The X-Cast, and X-Files podcast, where you can find our Patreon. This is who we are.